From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Every so often, we like to do the anatomy of a significant news story. One such broke last week in the Washington Post, describing a Pentagon briefing in which Saudi Arabia, a U.S. ally of 70 years standing, was described as our nation's enemy and a kernel of evil in the world. It ran Tuesday on page one, above the fold, and by Tuesday afternoon, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld was on the defensive himself, rejecting the story's premise, albeit none too forcefully.
Saudi Arabia is like any other country. It has a broad spectrum of activities and things, some of which obviously, just like our country, that we agree with and some we may not. It is nonetheless a country where we have a lot of forces located and we have had a long relationship.
Joining us now is the author of the story, Washington Post military correspondent Thomas Ricks. Tom, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about the story for a moment. The piece was about a briefing by an outside consultant connected with the RAND Corporation to the Defense Policy Board. What is the Defense Policy Board? It doesn't actually make defense policy.
No, it's a group of graybeards, wise men, basically retired senior military officers and former government officials, a couple of speakers of the House, a couple of former defense secretaries, people like that.
So in comes the consultant, a guy named Laurent Mirowich, and he is broaching the unbroachable thought that a key U.S. ally is actually a U.S. enemy. But it was one briefing before an advisory panel with no actual power. Yet all the sort of body language of the story and its placement on page one suggested that a radical shift in U.S. policy may be in the offing. Was it overplayed, or were those possibilities the reason it was played on page one?
You put your finger on the basic question my editors had about the story, which is, look, this guy's an outsider. He's talking to a bunch of people who only advise the Pentagon. So the significance of the story has to rest in how widely this view is held, how much it resonates. And I think the intensity reaction to it demonstrated to me, actually, that it was not overplayed. Rumsfeld, I thought, was most striking of all when he said that's not the dominant opinion in this government, which struck me as tacit admission that it was a minority opinion in this government. Also, I would quibble a little bit with your reading of the story. I had in mind not the predictive notion that this portended some kind of radical shift in U.S. policy, but rather something more concretely. The fact that this briefing had been given at the Pentagon and that the reaction of the advisory board had been to take it seriously indicated to me just how much the U.S. view of Saudi Arabia had changed since September 11th.
Now, one way to tell how much a story resonates is to see how the rest of the press plays it. You obviously had a clean scoop on the New York Times. So you go through the New York Times the next day, and you're looking to see what they do with it. Will they put it on page one and advance it somehow? Will they bury the story on A14? Or C, as it turns out, run not a word of it?
They're my competition, and I respect them a lot. All I would note is that in previous circumstances that I've had, the Times tends to keep its powder dry and then come back a week later as if it invented the story itself. For example, I'd point to the story I did on preemption, which picked up on the president's West Point speech. So I think we ran that on the morning of June 10th, and the Times didn't do anything and then came back a week later on Monday the 17th and led the paper with a story about, hey, there's this new thing called preemption.
Now, there was another piece in Slate.com by Jack Schaefer, who was trying to find out who this guy was, this consultant. It turns out that the guy is of uncertain bona fides, certainly an extremist, former connections to Lyndon LaRouche, and so forth. When you saw that piece, did it kind of give you a shudder of, oh my God, who have I rested my story on?
No, it was not a piece about Laurent Mirowich. It was a piece about, hey, this is being discussed seriously at the Pentagon.
So if it were Daffy Duck in there and the Defense Policy Board were listening, your story would still work?
Yes, because it goes to the question my editors originally had. How widely held is this view? That actually takes me to the origin of the story. I was sort of puzzling through the question of the Saudis. And so I was just trying to figure out what the relationship was. And one guy said, oh, you should see this briefing. This really summarizes the answers to your questions.
Well, listen, I know the story can't be right because I've seen the commercials from Saudi Arabia. They say they're our friends. I've seen the commercials.
It's funny you should say that because you could go mad trying to figure out the hidden agendas here. And you can't let yourself worry about that as a reporter. What struck me, though, was that a couple of agendas were served by the story. The neoconservatives, who had been had this story bubbling out there in their own publications, like the Weekly Standard, finally got this story into the political vocabulary of Washington. I think people at the State Department who have had some issues with Donald Rumsfeld were not entirely sad to be apologizing for the behavior of the Defense Department. And I also was wondering about Prince Bandar, the Saudi ambassador to the United States, whether this enabled him to go back in Riyadh and say, see, I've been telling you guys we got a huge problem with the U.S. government. Now will you listen to me? There's a variety of agendas that can be served by such a story, and not all of those are evident even to the reporter.
Let me tell you what the whole thing looks like from a distance. It looks like the Washington journalistic community in general has sort of been champing at the bit to find a way to put a face on all these whispers and rumblings. Do you think there was an element of that in the play that this story got?
Yeah. I was trying to hear that almost dog whistle level of sound about Saudi Arabia. What I had envisioned writing ultimately was a thumbsucker, as we call it in the business, which is, I don't really have any hard news here, but boy, there's a kind of lot of quiet worry going on here.
Sunday A1 below the fold?
Exactly. And my editors were to sort of, oh, let's do Rix a favor. It's probably worth laying down a marker, but he didn't really land a punch here. As it happened, though, sometimes you get lucky when you're asking the big questions and you come across something more concrete.
Tom Rix, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Thomas Rix is the military correspondent for The Washington Post, whose novel, A Soldier's Duty, has just been released in paperback by Random House.
As Thomas Rix just said, originally he planned to write a thumbsucker. Thumbsuckers abound in the dog days of summer when all your sources are out of town and all your leads grow cold. But there's something else about August, that just when you settle into the glacial pace, something huge pops up. August causes anxiety, at least in me, so I decided to call a reporter who loves working in August, Thomas Oliphant, longtime Washington columnist for the Boston Globe. Hello, Tom.
Hi, Brooke.
Do you get the same August anxiety I do?
All the time, and it's why I work in August. The first reason I love to work in August is that if everything goes right, you get to basically work at about half to three-quarter speed, getting paid full-time. I hope my boss isn't listening.
Don't worry, he's not.
That's good. But in the back of my head, I also know that on a regular basis, August has this wonderful habit of sneaking up behind you and biting you in the rear end with some really big stories that become, I think, especially enjoyable just as pure journalism because all the usual suspects are gone and they're hard stories to do.
Give me some examples.
Well, it started for me when I was a baby here. I was low man on the totem pole, which meant I had to work in August. And it was quiet. There was nothing going on. Get this call from the White House to come over because there's going to be a big announcement. And it turns out that was when Nixon sprang his surprise imposition of wage and price controls and the complete ending of the dollar's relationship to gold.
And this was pandemonium.
It was a gift that kept on giving throughout the month. And here I was about 28 years old with this delicious thing basically all to myself for a few days. But it was not the only time this has happened to me in my life. Watergate exploded over the summer of 1973, and of course Nixon resigned. The climax came in the first week of August of 1974.
We had a journalism historian on a few weeks ago who said that the summertime was the time for scandal. It tended to dominate the news. And I cast my mind back to last August. We were up to our eyeballs in Gary Condit.
We were. Scandals can go crazy out of all proportion in August. They don't always, but Gary Condit is certainly a classic example. Another example, back in 1977, August was when the disclosure that created the brouhaha over Burt Lance, Jimmy Carter's budget director, and his banking past, there had been aspects of this story that had surfaced months before when there was a lot of other news going on, and it hadn't made that much of a splash. But in August, it sure did.
So let's take those two examples. If something were to be disclosed about you, something you really would prefer people didn't pay much attention to, you wouldn't have it disclosed in August if you had a choice. When would the press be too busy to pay any attention?
Well, February, because there's so much of the major ritualistic events in Washington are unfolding at that time. The new session of Congress, the president's State of the Union message, his budget. In the case of Lance and Condit, I'm not sure either one could possibly have had the run it did against a normal diet of serious news.
But the reason why they did have that run, perhaps, is because of the traditional August doldrums. How do people usually deal with the doldrums?
In my end of the business, which is column writing, there has been a little tendency over the years to rely on what some people call evergreens, a column that can run any time. It isn't at all related to something specifically going on.
So what's a story that smells like an evergreen?
Well, if you were to read your favorite columnist saying that, by golly, global warming really is a serious problem, and we better do something about it. I mean, the classic one is if you see somebody writing to recommend what you should take with you to read on the beach.
Well, how are you dealing with August this time around then? What's your column this week?
Well, remember, the month is early. I took the first week in August off. And when I came back the following Tuesday, I had to have a piece ready. I was thinking as that first week in August was drawing to a close, thank God we just got reports on successive days about the gross domestic product and the unemployment situation, both of them indicating that the recovery is going to be a little slower and less vibrant than people thought it was going to be.
Good news for you.
Quite apart from the substance of the issue, I just remember thinking, oh my God, thank God, a little trend, that'll do.
Well, Tommy, I want to thank you for opening up like that.
I'll deny it.
Thomas Oliphant is a Washington columnist for the Boston Globe.
Coming up, the case for media violence, for kids anyway, and a goodbye to the Bard of Basketball.
This is On the Media from NPR.
We are back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The legendary Los Angeles Lakers broadcaster Chick Hearn died this week at the age of 85. On the Media's producer-at-large, Mike Pesca, had some thoughts on his life and legacy.
Most of the obituaries compare Chick Hearn to Cal Ripken because Hearn also was an Iron Man of sports. From 1965 through last season, he never missed a game. But I could think of another comparison. Not from the world he covered, sports, but from Hearn's own world, the world of words. With Hearn's death and the passing of broadcaster Marty Glickman over a year ago, basketball has lost its Chaucer and its Shakespeare. Glickman was Chaucer because he invented so many of the basic terms to describe the court and play, the vocabulary of basketball. Chick Hearn was Shakespeare because he wove those phrases into an evocative language that captured the spirit of the game. In various papers in the last few days, Hearn was also said to have invented phrases including airball, slam dunk, finger roll, give and go, and double dribble. That's doubtful. The double dribble was outlawed in 1908, 7 years before Hearn was born. Coaches like Fog Allen, who learned the game directly from its inventor, James Naismith, schooled their players in the art of the give and go. I called the librarian of the Basketball Hall of Fame, and he acknowledged that Hearn didn't coin many of the phrases he's been given credit for in the last week. But, like Shakespeare, he was the first to make that language accessible to everyone. And also like Shakespeare, he filled the airwaves with poetry and drama. Listen.
The rebound is off to Pippen. Pippen knocks a man down, no harm, no foul, no blood, no ambulance.
Street got the ball. Street yo-yoing up and down out in front against Michael Jordan. Street gets the screen by Campbell. Shoots a 22-footer. Soft as a baby going to bed. Nice shot.
Chick Hearn, a fellow of infinite jest, of most excellent fancy. For On the Media, I'm Mike Pesca.
Violence depicted in the media exacerbates violence in the streets, and children should be kept away from it. This parental article of faith has been borne out in various studies and accepted more or less as doctrine in Congress and elsewhere. But is it actually so? Gerard Jones says, well, no. He's a former screenwriter and comic book author, and author now of Killing Monsters, Why Children Need Fantasy, Superheroes, and Make-Believe Violence. Jones believes some media violence can play an important positive role in children's emotional development. He joins us now. Gerard, welcome to OTM.
Thanks for having me.
When my teenage girls, when they were maybe 10 and 7 years old, they at that time were on a very restricted television diet. And as an experiment one day, I showed them a cartoon that had been highly recommended by my brother. The cartoon was Ren and Stimpy, which was a very... violent, sardonic, grotesque, very bad taste. Well, my kids, my little girls, my pink, ruffled little girls, saw this cartoon and instantaneously, I mean instantaneously, went crazy and laughed and hooted and started upsetting furniture. And it was such a striking, direct effect of a small amount of violent television. You know, I became, on the basis of that anecdotal moment alone, a true believer in the relationship between televised violence and the real thing. Is this an anomaly, or do you think there's something going on there?
No, there's something going on. I think that's actually one of the really good functions of kind of aggressive, wacky entertainment, is it gets kids laughing. It throws off some of their constraint. It gets them doing crazy things in that really playful, controlled way. Because one thing, when you look at kids who actually behave violently in a serious way, in a destructive way, these are not kids who are being humorously playfully violent. You look at James McGee's profiles of the youthful rampage shooters, and none of these kids were class clowns. None of them used humor. None of them liked to have fun. You know, this is a very kind of a grim, obsessive, serious aggression.
But is there a fundamental difference between playing cowboys and Indians and what kids might play having witnessed gory, graphic, pathological violence in a film or on a video game?
The play is not that different, and I think that's one of the points to remember. Now, one thing, I'm a believer in kind of the old classic age appropriateness lines, because little kids can be troubled by something too intense or too realistic. They're still working on that separation of the real and unreal.
Now, what about, though, the societal nightmare that seemed to actually come to fruition in the 80s when, particularly in the inner city with gang violence and drug violence, we read so many times that kids were arrested for horrendous crimes without expressing remorse, presumably because they scarcely understood that there were real life and death stakes, that it was all just kind of a perverse game with real blood.
That holds up when you look at certain kinds of delusional, suicidal, homicidal kids, the kids who do the sort of the rage killing. I mean, there is a place there where we need to be concerned, because some of these kids do attach strongly to the media. It has not really held up when you're looking at kids in from bad households and in violent neighborhoods who are engaged in utilitarian crimes or this really sort of tough guy gang crime. It really seems to be a familial and a societal nexus, not a media nexus. I think we have to remember, and one of the discontinuities that people see that I think puzzles a lot of parents, they read the research and they hear the headlines and they think, okay, violent media equals violent behavior. And yet, one, they see that video gamers tend to be the really sweet, geeky kids. There's no place on earth safer than a video game convention. You know, these are the kids who are often afraid to speak out loud. And then at the same time, despite these occasional eruptions of, say, urban drug-driven crime, youth crime has actually been going down in this country quite steadily for over 20 years, even as the gaming and the more violent movies came in. So it doesn't really hold in real life.
All right, so what research did you do to draw these conclusions? There certainly have been a number of highly publicized studies which do connect violence in the media and violence in the society.
Most of it coming from other countries, which I think is unfortunate. I think there has to be a kind of a movement toward asking more questions in American media research, because all the research begins from the point of view of what is the harm done by media. I've spoken to a lot of psychologists who couldn't even get studies launched on the possible beneficial effects of some make-believe violence in the media. But there is material coming from Canada, from England, from Australia, from continental Europe, where people are looking more into things like, you know, kindergartners watching Power Rangers and finding that they seem to be a little more encouraged and a little more relaxed afterwards, and kids playing with toy guns and finding that they're more relaxed afterwards. So the evidence is out there and it's beginning, but we have to overcome this desire to find the negative only.
Gerard Jones, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Gerard Jones is author of Killing Monsters, Why Children Need Fantasy, Superheroes, and Make-Believe Violence.
Europe may not be as worried as we are about what the media are doing to young people, but right now in Hungary, the old guard are wringing their hands over what young people are doing to the media. Case in point, a young former Russian history teacher who has become a TV star by seducing her viewers while interviewing intellectuals, among others. And as Drew Leifheit reports from Budapest, the unconventional talk show host is now blazing a path to stardom for those who choose to follow.
On weekday mornings, a female host with a boyish haircut and a tan greets the viewers of a breakfast TV show called Incredibly Awakening. A gaudy chain dangling from her neck, she's perched on a sofa wearing a pair of cutoffs and a tight-fitting leather bra. Viewers call in, and she and her co-hosts respond to their comments and questions. Known as Anetka, 28-year-old Annette Fehad is the star of the show. Over the past year, this woman, who also belly dances, does the twist, and piano dusts in the buff on late-night TV, has become Hungary's most controversial media figure. Anetka says she's unique in the media because no one else interviews famous writers, poets, and artists in addition to strip-teasing.
So viewers got something which was really non-traditional in Hungary, and no one had done it before, because if someone stars in an erotic show, people think she must be an educated and uncultured person who isn't able to find any other way of living. Everyone saw that wasn't true in my case, because in the other shows, they could see that these were not my main characteristics.
Still, Anetka's also known for cursing back at callers who say nasty things about her on the air, and she's received penalties from the Hungarian Radio and TV Board. Not surprisingly, her naked photos are regularly splashed onto the pages of the Hungarian tabloids. And just last week, Anetka's infamy hit the radio waves in Budapest following the release of a CD featuring her own song stylings of Hungarian standards, which immediately spawned a parody. Dearest Anetka, goes the radio station parody, I've fallen in love with your voice. You're the only one I need. I'm disappointed with goats. Ferenc Hammer is a media theorist at Eötvös Loránd University in Budapest. Hammer says the commercial TV scene in Hungary is still very young, and consequently, when a controversial celebrity like Anetka appears, reactions vary. Some stare, some turn up their noses, and some applaud.
They either like her, or just maybe want to shiver a little, or, oh, how strange, oh, what strange things are on TV.
Homer says the reaction from media figures, however, was quite consistent.
They just take her as a farce or as something like a freak, media freak or something. So they don't acknowledge her success, basically.
Onetka's forays into new territory aren't limited to just pop music or TV. 2 months ago, she also started her own media school, enlisting the help of TV personalities, sports reporters, and media specialists as teachers. Onetka says when members of the Hungarian media found out about her plan, she was buried under an avalanche of criticism. But despite this, 25 students enrolled in the program.
I don't think you have to attend the university for 6 or 7 years and then take a job at a big commercial TV station, carting microphones from one place to the next for no money. If someone has perseverance, personality, talent, and self-confidence, and they have an understanding of something, anything concerning the media, then here they can be a star, and I will help them in any way I can.
As for her role in the curriculum, Onetka says she only teaches her specialties, live TV hosting and raising funds for production. While she admits there are a lot of media schools in Hungary, she says her school's competitive edge is its location.
Mine differentiates itself from the others in that there is a working TV station behind it. We don't teach theory. The kids don't have to memorize 400-page textbooks, and they don't have exam periods over a period of 4 years. They learn everything here at the station.
One example of the hands-on experience is a twice-monthly live student program called GAZ, a slang word which means controversy in Hungarian. The show consists of two average-looking young men and a tall blonde woman sitting on pillows on the studio floor, along with Onetka and her lollipop-sucking co-host. For half an hour, they chat about whatever strikes them, while two cameramen dart around the set, sometimes shooting at odd angles. One of the guy students boasts about how many women he's had sex with, while the blonde student shows the others her big tobacco water pipe. When the half hour is over, a producer tells them that something was missing from the show, but he's not exactly sure what it is. 25-year-old student Veronika Haiti says she's feeling more comfortable in front of the camera. Although she's attending another media program, she believes she'll learn more at Anetka's school and has plans for her own TV show.
It will be an erotic show. The concept's not completely worked out, but I'd like it to be provocative and feminist-oriented, where the women are at the forefront exhibiting their finer characteristics. I'll be naked, but I don't want to show myself, but want the whole thing to be suggestive for male and female viewers.
They want to appear on TV. They want to be famous. It's not so complicated, I think.
Media professor Ferenc Hommer says the degree from Onetka's school wouldn't carry much weight in academic circles, and he notes that academic programs provide students with the context and history of Hungarian broadcasting.
It's one thing to open a media school, and another is what can people do with the degree, what they get from there.
As for Onetka's students, she proudly reports that one of them has already received a job offer from another TV station. And she says her next project is to star as a go-go girl in a play written specifically for her. For On the Media, this is Drew Leifheit in Budapest.
Now for some of your letters. John Reinch writes from Seattle, suggesting I was too easy on Dave Morey from the Council on Foreign Relations. We were discussing the government's latest effort to win the hearts and minds of the rest of the world. Reinch writes, at one point, Morey mentions that we are perceived to be without empathy. Well, do we, or rather do those who act in our names? Defense Secretary Rumsfeld has repeatedly displayed his indifference to civilian casualties in Afghanistan. And in all the talk about going after Saddam, the question of how many innocent Iraqis would perish never comes up. If people don't perceive any empathy in this attitude, it's because there is none.
On our story about newspaper accuracy, many of you were quick to point out the irony of an error within the error story. Adrian Dunstan of Raleigh, North Carolina, particularly enjoyed the piece and wrote this: "I was delighted that Mr. Solomon chose to drive his point home by including one of the minor errors he was reporting on in his report. Just so you know, the major newspaper here is the News and Observer, not the News Observer. Good luck to checking those names and facts in the future."
Nice catch, Adrian, and everybody else on the OTM screw-up patrol. But tell you what, you do the listening and noticing, we'll do the sarcasm, all right?
Turns out our mistakes did not end with our report on errors. Pete Flugstad of Iowa City, Iowa, wrote in to tell us that in our letters segment last week, quote, "Your reporter read the phrase 128 kilobytes per second in association with a network speed of digital audio. Network speeds are almost always listed as kilobits or megabits per second."
We had a lot of positive reaction to our exploration last week of The Thing's Jewish roots. He's one of Marvel Comics' Fantastic Four. But we also received another correction. We identified the legendary comic book writer Stan Lee as the creator of the Silver Surfer, among other characters. But not so, says Eric Evans. Evans writes, "There is quite a bit of evidence that Stan Lee created nothing but dialogue for Marvel Comics. Lee himself has told the story on several occasions that when he first saw the Silver Surfer, he had no idea who the character was or what he was doing in Fantastic Four's comic. Kirby created the Silver Surfer out of whole cloth, and Lee has admitted as much when pressed."
Rivetti, what's up?
I'm sorry, sir. It's just a difference of opinion that got out of hand.
What about?
Well, I said that the Kirby Silver Surfer was the only real Silver Surfer, and that the Mobius Silver Surfer was things got out of hand. I pushed him, he pushed me. It's never happened again, all
right? It better not happen again. I see this kind of nonsense, I'm gonna write you up. You understand? You have to set an example even in the face of stupidity. Now, everybody that reads comic books knows that Kirby Silver Surfer is the only true Silver Surfer. Now, am I right or wrong?
You're right, sir.
All right. Get out of here.
Yes, sir.
We enjoy all of your comments and corrections, and we love the arguments, so send them to us at onthemedia@wnyc.org, and don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. Up next, an unwritten rule of Broadway gets broken, why the government is determined to get a digital TV tuner in your house, and the world's oldest Pentagon reporter.
This is On the Media from NPR. Back with On the Media, I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, in an effort to speed up the nation's transition to digital TV, the FCC ordered television manufacturers to install digital tuners on all sets by 2007. This is guaranteed to push up the price of TVs, prompting howls from manufacturers and consumer groups. The FCC's order stems back to the Balanced Budget Act of 1997, when Congress required all broadcasters to send their signals digitally by 2006. But that only applied in areas where 85% of Americans could receive the digital broadcasts. In the ensuing years, one delay has begotten another, and here to comb it all out for us is Michael Fremmer, contributing editor of the Stereophile Guide to Home Theater. Michael, welcome to the show.
It's great to be back, Brooke.
Okay, so why and why now?
What's happening is there's a lot of pressure for the digital transition to take place so consumers can watch high-definition television and digital television in their homes. It's happening much slower than it was supposed to be happening for a variety of reasons. Right now, it's only being broadcast over the air. 90% of people get their television from satellite and cable. And so the fact that it's being broadcast over the air does not do most people any good. The cable industry has been very slow to pick up on HDTV and DTV because it takes a lot of bandwidth to broadcast high-definition television. There is not a big incentive economically for them to do it. Meanwhile, the FCC that's in charge of most of this has been doing very little because Michael Powell is a laissez-faire kind of Republican. He wants everybody to work the issues out and let the market take over. Well, that's not happening.
So if Michael Powell is, as you say, laissez-faire, why is he suddenly pressing television manufacturers to upgrade their sets and causing consumers groups to cry that this is unfair to consumers?
There's a lot of pressure from Congress to make the transition happen faster. Because when the analog wavelengths are given back to the government, they will auction it off, and there'll be about a $20 to $60 billion income for the government. This money will lower the amount of the deficit. Originally, it was going to be part of the surplus. Now it's supposed to lower the deficit. And the more they can lower the deficit, the better the politicians will look. So there's a lot of pressure from Congress on Powell. He has to do something.
Why do you think Congress's motivation in this case is principally financial?
Because they need the revenue.
Have you been hearing from people on the Hill who have said that?
Yes. The people on the committees that are involved in this, that saw this as a way for the government to make money, now see it as a way for the government to simply lower the deficit. It is definitely, to a great degree, a financial issue.
Well, is this the best way to transition to digital TV? If, as you say, 90% of people get their television from cable and satellite, why don't they just use the must-carry rules and get cable systems to pick up the digital signals?
That's what Powell was pressured to do by certain groups all along, and he was loath to do that. The must-carry rule, of course, mandates that cable systems have to carry local channel programming. They have to carry the analog channels. It could have been mandated that they also have to carry the digital channels. There would have been a court case over that, but he should have tried that, but that's not in his nature to do that. So there's this bluster about this terrestrial digital tuner being put in every set. 90% of consumers will be paying for this and not be able to use it.
You don't think this will speed the transition to digital? What do you think the impact will be?
The impact will simply be to bring the price of the sets up. How much that's a matter of contention as well. How many people are going to want to put up antennas on their roofs with rotors so they can get the signal? How many people can actually do that? If you're in big city apartments, you can't do it. If you're living in a rural area, you can't do it. If you're living in a suburban or city area that has a lot of mountains like Los Angeles, San Francisco, or Denver, you're not going to be able to pick up the signal anyway. The only way the digital transition is going to really occur is if the cable companies begin providing the service and the satellite companies begin providing the service. Satellite is willing to do it. If DirecTV and EchoStar can be allowed to merge, that will speed the transition, but there are a lot of people on the Hill against that.
But cable systems don't seem to want to do it.
Well, the cable systems have to wake up because the cable systems have invested a lot of money in fiber optics and all kinds of other expensive bandwidth-enhancing technologies in order to provide consumers with interactive video and with pay-per-view. What's happened is they have not been able to derive the income from that because consumers are buying big-screen televisions and seeing how great a picture they can get with DVDs and how good a sound they can get with DVDs, and the cable companies are still offering fuzzy 4x3 pictures with bad sound for pay-per-view.
So then ultimately they'll get the message and start to offer digital, won't they?
That's what we have to hope. We have to hope that they realize that the only way to get this is to offer high definition and charge consumers for it. The people with the deep pockets will pay the money for the better picture and sound once they see it. Most consumers, when they see a high definition picture, they go, oh my God, how do I get that? I want to have that.
Okay, Michael, this brings me back to the first question I asked you. If this is a really inefficient way to speed the transition to digital, then why did the FCC take this approach?
Powell says this is not a market-oriented policy, quote, this is an industrial policy. I don't buy either one of those. This is a political decision. It is in everyone's interest to have all the sets able to pick up the digital signal. I agree with that. It's a good public policy, just like they put V-chip and other things into sets mandated by the government. But as far as speeding along the digital transition, I don't see this as being anything other than a political move to take the heat off the FCC.
Well, Michael, thank you very much.
It was my pleasure, Brooke.
Michael Fremmer is a contributing editor to Stereophile Guide to Home Theater. On July 24th, New York Newsday printed an unfavorable review of Moving Out, the Twilight Tharp production with music by Billy Joel, now at the Schubert Theater in Chicago. Actually, what it published was the review in its sister publication, the Chicago Tribune. Well, you know how sensitive artists can be. Theater folk are in a rage because of what appears to be a breach of a long-standing gentleman's agreement that New York newspapers will refrain from reviewing shows that open out of town until they come to New York. Moving Out is Broadway-bound. It's presumably being tweaked in Chicago in accordance with a long-standing theater tradition. Joining me now is Frank Rich, op-ed columnist for The New York Times and New York Times drama critic for over a decade. Frank, welcome back to On the Media.
Nice to be here.
So there is an agreement of sorts, isn't there?
There is. The system grew up when every Broadway show tried out of town, and it was understood that Broadway critics would wait for these Broadway shows to come into New York and have their official openings and review them then. But there are so few shows, that Broadway shows, that try it out of town now that there's tremendous focus on each of them. So what's happened is that theater columnists in New York now routinely refer at least to what the out-of-town critics are saying about these shows when they open in a place like Chicago.
The Times has a roundup column that does that during the year, but they don't print an entire review the way that Newsday did of the Chicago Tribune.
What Newsday did was an interesting wrinkle. Newsday did not send its New York critic to review it. So in essence, they weren't breaking this agreement. Part of the gentleman's agreement has always been about the fact that the New York critics would not prejudge a show based on its unfinished version. And so the Newsday's actual critic remains a virgin to the show because she can say, I didn't see that previous version. And what's the difference between running the full Chicago Tribune review, which we happen to own because we're part of the same company, as opposed to having a paragraph summary of it in the Times or the Post or somewhere else?
Because you haven't prejudiced New York audiences against a production that may still be in progress.
There are two other factors I would add into the mix to make a case for what Newsday did. One is, in the days of the Internet, every theater person who really cares can find these reviews in full in an instant anyway, which was not true for most of the history of the theater. You had to go to an out-of-town newsstand and maybe find the Chicago Tribune on the right day. Now anyone can get it with a click. And also, ticket prices are so high that you can't really blame consumers for wanting to do all the research before they spend $100 a ticket.
Okay, so do those two things render the gentleman's agreement now obsolete?
They don't render it obsolete. I think it's, speaking as a former critic, I think that it's the proper role of a New York theater critic to review the play that opens in New York.
You were a drama critic, now you're an op-ed columnist. You must have in mind the news imperative. I mean, a Billy Joel story, Billy Joel is a New York native son, that's news. Isn't there a sort of journalistic imperative to report on news?
Absolutely. And that's why, by the way, in the 1940s, the New York Times ran summaries of the out-of-town reviews of A Streetcar Named Desire or of South Pacific before they came to New York, because it was news. So the Billy Joel in Chicago situation is exactly analogous to that. And the only difference is that Newsday ran a whole Chicago review, whereas the Times in 1949 in South Pacific would have written a summary of such a Chicago review.
Do you think the producers who have protested against what Newsday did last month are just a bunch of crybabies?
Yes. Quite frankly, everyone's going to find out anyway that Moving Out did not get great reviews in Chicago. But if the show is fixed, assuming it's broken, and turns out to be great, no one will remember, no one will care. And that's also part of the history of the theater. No one remembers that Fiddler on the Roof and Hello, Dolly got terrible reviews during their Detroit tryouts, even though those bad reviews were publicized in the New York papers at the time. But once the shows opened and became hits, it was all past history.
Well, Frank Rich, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
Great talking with you.
Frank Rich is an op-ed columnist for The New York Times and a longtime past drama critic for that paper.
My name is Raymond Cromley. My job is as a newspaper man. I'm at the Pentagon, right across from where they hand out news when they're permitted to.
Meet Raymond Cromley. We read about this singular journalist on the front page of the Wall Street Journal in a story that looked quizzically and affectionately at the oldest member of the Defense Department press corps. Cromley is 91, vigorous and diligent, albeit somewhat on the unprolific side. He hasn't written a column since 1996. Recently, I stopped by the Pentagon cubicle of Cromley News Features to chat with him, a conversation that began with him describing a typical workday.
You get up in the morning, you come down here and park your car, and then I read all the available newspapers to see what is the type of news today, depending on what's happening and the type of thing I go off on. Now, I've tried to build up a big enough background in all types of fields so that I can shift from being a guerrilla in World War II to doing whatever else I've done during my life. I think that's what gives you the feeling that you can know what people want to hear about.
The similarities between journalism and intelligence gathering are a recurring theme with Ray Cromley, and no wonder. The man has been around. He began his journalism career with the Wall Street Journal as a Far East correspondent in the early days of the Second World War, the beginning of a long career quickly interrupted by adventurous and historic service as an operative for Army intelligence. For example, toward the end of the war, with the future of China still uncertain, Cromley hunkered down in the caves of Yan'an with Mao Zedong, on whose behalf Cromley dispatched a cable to President Franklin Roosevelt, seeking a path toward Sino-American cooperation.
What he wanted to do was to talk to Roosevelt and have his right-hand man, Joe and I, go with him to talk to American trade, American investments in China, American sales in China, and Chinese sales in America. And that's what he wanted. He would talk to the very thing.
A trade mission.
That's what he wanted. It was a brilliant idea.
That cable, however, was intercepted and quashed by then-U.S. Ambassador to China, Patrick J. Hurley, a missed diplomatic opportunity thought by some historians to have changed the face of the 20th century. After the Japanese surrender, Cromley went back to journalism to cover the Cold War, armed with skills and a mentality informed by his Army experience.
One of my big problems was locating their spies in the United States. For instance, I slept a few nights sleeping under the bed of one of the biggest enemies in the United States. I actually slept under his bed.
As a newsman?
Don't worry. He was asleep.
Did you get anything?
Yes. I got who his allies were and who his enemies were.
Did a story come out of this?
Sure. But I was very careful about my attribution.
How did you get under the bed?
Crawled under it.
How did you get into the house?
Look, in the type of work I was doing, you could climb into the Emperor's Palace if you wanted to. And I did, as a matter of fact.
Mr. Cromley is coy with the specifics. He says he's not at liberty to disclose them. Although there is also the fact that at his age, the mind does play tricks.
What other stories did you cover? Were you in this office during the Vietnam War filing stories for Cromley News Features?
Yes, I guess I was. It was here. Well, I have to get myself adjusted to it. I can't see. Well, oh, yes.
Memory problem.
Yeah, memory problem. I'm sure I can remember what happened. I could always bring it back to memory if you leave me a little time and a few things to do.
Eventually, it did come back to him. In 1975, he founded Cromley News Features, which in its heyday numbered 300 subscriber newspapers for his twice-weekly columns on military affairs. Now that number is down to zero, and though he reports to the Pentagon every day, it has been a decade since he reported to anyone else. Still, as the Journal indelibly recorded in its story, Cromley dutifully attends defense briefings and jots notes on 3x5 cards for a big story to be written when, but not until, the time is right.
You haven't been filing stories for Cromley News Features, have you? When's the last time you actually wrote a story?
I have not been very active recently. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Well, but I have been very active in gathering information. So when I get ready to write, I will know what I will write about. I'll write a book or begin writing columns. I've got these banks of knowledge. I'm watching very closely this war we're fighting in Asia at the moment. And because I am seeing in my mind, aha, this is good for something, this is good for something, this is good for something. I've got stories sitting here, which I'm not going to mention now because I don't want somebody to beat me at my own thing of what I'm going to write about.
So you're keeping your powder dry.
Yeah.
And someday, kaboom.
At the right time.
If you never convert those note cards, those 3x5 cards, and all of what is inside your head into a book or a series of stories or a revived Cromley news features, will you be disappointed?
I'd feel I missed the boat. The thing is, you think tomorrow is always coming. One of these days, whether it's tomorrow or 150, which is what I'm aiming at now, you never know the future. And my mistake is sometimes the same, I'll go after this because I can hold this till tomorrow. If I died tomorrow, a lot of this I collected would be wasted. But I don't intend to die tomorrow.
Raymond Cromley, the oldest living Defense Department correspondent, on a summer's day at the Pentagon. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers with Sean Landis, engineered by George Edwards and Dylan Keefe, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Dan Bobkoff. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large, Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Bydell Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.